Welcome to Indie Radio Garden. This week's highlights from community radio in the Philadelphia region.
This program brings ordinary citizens to the air to discuss issues related to health, race, safety, workers' rights, and the will to survive in pandemic times.
The first clip comes from WPPMLP 106.5 PhillyCam. Recent reports have found that 4 in 10 Philadelphia households, including 54% of renters and 28% of homeowners, are cost-burdened, meaning they spend at least 30% of their income on housing costs. During this segment of Community Voice Philly Talk Show, Jacqueline Jordan and Jeff Jones talk about addressing this challenging issue in the city of brotherly love.
When affordable housing isn't affordable anymore, the high cost of living across the nation, despite being less expensive than most other large cities, Philadelphia has a significant affordable housing problem and needs to explore a variety of ways to address this problem. The recent report found that 4 in 10 Philadelphian households, including 54% of renters and 28% of homeowners, are cost burdened, meaning that at least 30% of their income go towards housing. And that's tough to deal with, right? And it impacts their ability to economically grow, build families, raise families, have jobs. And this housing issue is really, really a boon in the side of our society. And we really have to address this issue, Jack. It's hurting on so many levels. It bleeds over into so many different aspects of our daily living. Where only 30% of their income goes towards housing. That's tough. What do we do, Jack?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is one of those tough situations for me, because I myself have faced, you know, issues with housing insecurity. And so it creates a level of anxiety when I start hearing that, right? According to the National Low Income Housing Coalition, no state, county, or city in the entire country where a full-time minimum wage worker working 40 hours a week can afford a 2-bedroom rental. So that's no state, no county or city in the country where a full-time minimum wage worker working 40 hours a week can afford a 2-bedroom rental. Mm-hmm. And this goes like beyond just housing, right? We're always talking about rest, right? And rest for our folks and what that means and the importance of that. You're asking somebody who's working full-time 40 hours a week to now get a second minimum wage job to even scrape by. We're not even talking about being able to afford. We're talking about barely scraping by. And so for the folks who tend to be elitists, who listen to our show, who think that it can never be them, right, that this would never happen to me, talk to some of those folks in California. Talk to the lawyers and the doctors and, you know, the architects and the creatives and all of those folks who at one point were making great money. And one situation forced them into a situation where they have now housing insecurity. Talk to folks in Philadelphia. We have the stigma around the homeless, around those who are transitioning. We have stigma around that all the drug users, they all have mental health issues. Nope. It's a lot of people in them shared food lines that and we've seen that during the pandemic, that work a full-time job that pays above minimum wage, that in reality on paper, they should be able to afford feed themselves and their children. But the reality on paper is not the reality of life. And so we got to be careful when we start getting in this place of judgment, when we start judging people, because really it could be any one of us. MJ talks about this all the time. He talks about all it takes is one incident for most people, one situation, take you out of here, take you out of a space of comfort. And we really got to start talking about this. Speaking of California, the Black population in California is small as compared to other states. But according to CaliMatters.org, 30% of those homeless experiencing homelessness are Black people.
Yeah.
And so you got a mix of gentrification, got to mix up all of this stuff, you know, that's happening. We're so focused sometimes politically. We're so focused one-sided, you know, in most cases, that we don't start thinking about some of these other things that are occurring. Working in a school. Kids ain't eating, y'all. Our seniors aren't eating. Our seniors are deciding between paying rent, buying food, and medication.
Yeah, because it all goes hand in hand, though, Jack. I mean, you know, if they're having trouble sustaining affordable housing, rent, mortgage, then they're going to be then bleeding over into having trouble providing substances and resources and food for their children or themselves. So it all bleeds over. These kids, for the most part, aren't coming to school hungry just because, you know, mom or dad or mom, depending on their household, just doesn't want to feed them. They maybe have multiple children in the household or maybe just the one child. And it's just hard to sustain it. I mean, Philadelphia is really, you know, I got my thumb on a pulse with Philadelphia in a lot of regards to this issue. They have, you know, the land bank, but that's kind of like a farce in itself because, you know, it's really facilitated by city council, which really doesn't do a great job in parsing out the land in a way that can be beneficial towards those who needed to build affordable housing. All those, there can be tiny housing. It was a project at one time for tiny housing, small affordable housings to be built on these lands that the land bank encompassed. But that project went astray. So I'm like, what are we doing to help these individuals who are housing insecure and have these challenges? And me, myself, I've experienced it being out on the streets for several years. So, you know, I know that pain. I know the challenge of trying to get yourself back into a position of being stable homeowner or renter. And it's just horrible. And I know you mentioned it's not just the Black folk in Philadelphia. 32% of white folk are experiencing this. And of those 32%, 15% are upward bound professionals. So some of those executives or managers of some of these companies, they don't have no place to live or a stable place to live. They're couch hopping or couch surfing, as they would say. You know, they don't have a stable place to live.
I'm glad you mentioned that there's a difference between, you know, homelessness and housing insecurity, right? Yeah. And sometimes people who are facing housing insecurity are not included in those numbers because they physically have a roof over their head, but it does not belong to them. Not stable in that space.
Yeah. But again, that's part of how the numbers get skewed in that space. But we really have to look at how we want to deal with this. And I know that with a lot of gentrification that's taking place, one of the things that was brought up in one of the city council meetings was like, have these developers make some of the apartment units or luxury units affordable, right? Or donate funds towards the Affordable Housing Coalition, I believe. I forget what the exact title is. Donate a portion of the funds towards that. Now, at first, they thought the developers were going to build some of those units to be affordable. But no, what did the developers do? They took the easy way out and said, no, I don't want to make any of my units affordable. I'll donate money to this fund. So now here you have developers coming in, subverting the process of trying to create affordable housing instead of making it mandatory for these developers to have affordable housing in these units, not giving them a choice to either or, because they're choosing to say, okay, if you're giving me a choice to whether you make these units, affordable or donating to this fund, I'm going to donate to these funds because I want that money. And it pushes us meaning Black folk, people of color in particular, out on the outskirts of housing insecurity, homelessness, or continually transitioning and never a stable home to be in. And again, it's challenging for me when I deal with some of the young students and they talk about how they don't have an address because they don't know where they're going to be at, you know, and it's just challenging in that space to be like, wow, you know, doing great in school, probably end up at a lot of colleges, universities, but they don't have an address. They don't have a stable home. And that's disheartening. So affordable housing has to be looked at. 50% of our Hispanic brothers and sisters are suffering in this category, 46% Blacks, 33% Asians, and 32% whites. So it's not just us, but all I care about is us, to be honest with you.
I take care of our people. We got to take care of our people all the way around.
We'll be circling back on this to make sure we get, you know, some support in that regard. And again, if you have any feedback or thoughts or comments on how we can help or, you know, how we should address this issue, send us an email, communityvoicephl@gmail.com, because affordable housing should be affordable and one job should be enough to sustain a family. Two, if you're, you know, with a significant other, but one job should be enough. It really should.
The second audio comes from WHGELP 95.3, Afro-American Historical Society of Delaware. Patrice Gibbs, the host from The Open Eye Show, interviews Dr. Yasser Payne from the University of Delaware about critical race theory.
WHGE 95.3 FM, the education station. It's time for The Open Eye. Yeah, I'm your third eye optometrist, Patrice Gibbs. I have a very special guest, Dr. Payne. Welcome to the Open Eye, Dr. Payne.
Thank you, Mr. Gibbs. It's a pleasure to be with you.
All right. We've been celebrating Juneteenth since the 1980. That's when they started really
And they were celebrating it before in Galveston, Texas. They've been celebrating it for probably a century.
Right.
But since 1980, I would say it's spread throughout the country. We didn't ask for a Juneteenth holiday. We asked for police reform, and they gave us Juneteenth.
Obviously, this is a robust conversation that's taking place in the neighborhoods, particularly black neighborhoods all across the country. This is the alternative narrative that I think is easily dismissed. Mm-hmm. And or not enough attention paid. Mm-hmm. And then what we see in terms of the conversation represented more so in the mainstream is really a misrepresentation of most black people feel about the federal, this now federal holiday. Like you said, you know, we wanted police reform. We wanted, to be honest with you, you know, reparations. Mm-hmm. That's really the dominant conversation that's taking place right now. Mm-hmm. And we need more folk inside neighborhoods and communities, particularly black neighborhoods, particularly those black Americans descended of the slave South, really making an argument for the reparations that have been owed, and it's way overdue. Mm-hmm. That really will help with the kind of change and a transformation that we're all seeking, right? Because when we get our reparations, police reform, well, we don't have to think about police, we can think about it very differently. We can think about schools very differently, and our approach to improving these systems, right? As long as we're beholden, and long as we are forced into inequality and beholden to, you know, an establishment that's not interested in our liberation, you know, as long as we're within that context, it will always be difficult to obtain the kind of change that we need and deserve. In reparation, it allows us to create our own reality. You know, and in that new reality, we get to set the rules and create the parameters and the boundaries and the goals and the priorities in ways that serve us. And that's up to and including policing, right? So I think with the discussion that's been taking place in regard to Juneteenth, it has also conveniently covered over or found a way to now squash, I think, that fiery discussion of reparations that's still taking place. I also think, you know, we've been hearing a lot about critical race theory, and that theory has been founded by the name of Derrick Bell, right? He's the founder of it, right? And he's a radical, critical legal scholar that really put it on the line. And a lot of folk don't really understand the legacy of critical race theory in the ways that it ultimately deserves, because it's a big and broad theory, and unless you really get inside it, and it may be difficult to fully grasp. So I'm a critical race scholar, and I teach it. I'm at the University of Delaware. But with that said, one of the most famous concepts that undergird this theory, right, is his argument about racial symbolism. Mm-hmm. That's Derrick Bell. That's critical race theory. Mm-hmm. That's who's advancing that argument. Mm-hmm. And he's making and definitely in his classic book, Faces at the Bottom of the Well, which is a New York Times seller that comes out in 92, mm-hmm. Which is all about critical race theory. He's making that argument, particularly in that book, I think in relation to Martin Luther King Jr. and it being a national holiday. Mm-hmm. And he's making this argument about racial symbolisms and how that's a clever ploy, strategy by the establishment, right, to create what critical race scholar Michelle Alexander also argues. So what's the purpose of racial symbolism? Well, the establishment is more invested in what she describes as the impression of change, the oppression of it, right? At the end of the day, the economy is organized around anti-blackness. It is organized around an economic outgroup. That group primarily has always been black Americans descended of the slave South. That specific racial ethnic group, that is our purpose, that is our function, right? So when you think about it from that perspective and you humble yourself to what is actually going on, and it's not until you get into that space will you be able to really offer an intervention that has any shot at dealing with the problem. Our inequality, our bottom castness, plight with structural violence, right? That is part of, he says, Derrick Bell says, that's permanent and required. Economic poverty, Ruth Gilmore, another critical race scholar also argues, and I'm quoting, poverty is required. And it's not until you get your head wrapped around that, that you are the dinner. And if privilege is to be ensured, right, to folk like me included, right, I'm part of the hypocrisy, right? But if privilege is to be bestowed within this socioeconomic reality, then it requires an outgroup. And that's why everybody's kind of falling apart in media and all of that, you know, on the right and on the left, because this idea, right, is sticking. It's a very powerful idea, thought, ideology, theory, right? And it's one of the best theories, right? It's a theory that's so spot on, and it's one of the best theories to clarify or explain what is actually going on in our reality. And it's hard to debunk. That's why it's become so frustrating. You know, you can't just easily dismiss it, because you got to dismiss it with an empirical argument,
right?
You know, and the data in those other arguments, they don't quite add up, right? In the ways that when you get underneath this argument.
You know, that's something, because when you say you have to argue, you have to debate it from an empirical stance.
Yes, what you're seeing in the media in terms of critical race theory and schools is a fierce misrepresentation, absolutely, right? Critical race theory, by and large, is not taught in public schools, right? And that's across the country, that's black, white, and otherwise in terms of the communities, right? It's not, for the most part, public schools, particularly those black public schools, right, we teach the test. I will say, though, in all fairness, you do have instances, particularly of private schools, and these are well-funded, well-resourced, usually private schools that may have a liberal wing or a liberal set of educators that may teach middle schoolers or high schools critical race theory. That is rare. That's generally in the more privileged schools. And, you know, and I actually think, wow, that is pretty interesting. Right? But it's not necessarily occurring at the public level as much as we think.
The third clip comes from WRGULP 92.9 FM, Germantown United CDC, from the show Neighborly Chats. David Juro interviews Jill Saul of Germantown Mutual Aid Fund. They speak about how they utilize mutual aid to help their neighbors, the ethos behind mutual aid, and their allocation process.
On today's episode of Neighborly Chats, I'm speaking with Jill Saul of Germantown Mutual Aid Fund and GREAT, or Germantown Residents for Economic Alternatives Together.
I'm one of the nine fierce women who make up the group GMAF and sit on the panel to review requests from people in the neighborhood for financial support. It started, I think our first gathering and meetings was in April of 2020, and I believe we gave our first gifts in May of 2020, and we've been gifting twice a month since. First of all, I will just tell you that I often find myself on committees and in groups that I accidentally stumble into, and that is what happened with Germantown Mutual Aid Fund. Lindsay Stolke, who is very involved and one of the curators of GREAT and of the Mutual Aid Fund, we all got together and we started talking about how can we support the people in our community in Germantown during the pandemic? How can we help stabilize them and not just help them survive, but thrive during this time when people's jobs are at risk. They have to make the hard choice to stay home because their children are in school and they're going to be at home now for virtual learning, all kinds of things. So it was born out of the pandemic and the need to want to care for the people in our immediate community. There's lots of nonprofits out there. There's lots of places to get food, clothing. There's lots of those kinds of things. There's lots of agencies that you can go through to get help. And we wanted to make it less cumbersome. We wanted it to be very direct. We wanted to take away as much of the red tape as possible. People have a lot of stresses and anxieties in general, especially people who are in the lower income brackets trying to make ends meet. And on top of everything, with the pandemic and their bills piling up and they're not able to keep up with things because of the lack of work or the reduced hours or whatever, we really wanted to create something that gave people a little bit of a relief. So that's why we didn't want to have like an agency. That's our application. Our request for funding is very direct. It doesn't ask a lot of questions. It is really pretty simple. And even for those who do find any amount of application process stressful, we offer support and help and do it for them or with them just to make it less cumbersome. We've raised over $150,000 to date, and we have helped approximately 140 families. And believe me, when we started this out, we were like, oh, we're going to raise $10,000. And then we're like, no, let's really go for it. We're going to raise $25,000. And it did not take us very long to reach that goal. And this is one of the other inspiring things, is the majority of the money that we've raised have come from people right here in our community. $10, $25, $100, when people were getting their stimulus checks and they didn't really need their stimulus checks, they were still working, whatever, people donated $1,200 to us. We've had a number of different institutions give us some major gifts. A lot of different people have, you know, found ways to do their thing. We have people who are monthly sustainers of $10 a month, that kind of thing. And people just like you and I, who are just like, this is something I want to be able to support my neighbor. And so that has been very inspiring to me.
Something else I asked Jill was what specific debt or expense these gifts were meant to pay for.
We are not buying food or clothing for people. We are paying your bills. So mostly we are helping with rent. That has been the biggest thing that we've been requested. Rent, utilities, sometimes an unpaid medical bill, or maybe your car needs to get inspected because it's the way to get to work. You know, those kinds of things, just to kind of keep you where you're at. In addition to the financial help that we give people, we also have a list of resources that we've been compiling over the pandemic. Resources to other agencies who also might be able to help with rent, but who also might be able to give mental health support or other social services support. So we've partnered quite a bit with the Germantown Avenue Crisis Ministry. We've also partnered with Face to Face Germantown, the Unitarian Outreach Group, who are specifically just for seniors. You help seniors out. We give you this one thing, but we're also directing you to other places and other resources, and we have a direct connection with many of them. And in addition to that, we also give people a list of places where the community fridges are, places that give out food on a regular basis. For situations where the problem is bigger than what we can do, what we can handle, we'll give what we can to that person, but we'll also direct them to an agency who might be able to further aid them in their need. We've kind of turned into a general resource. If you need specific financial help for a bill, for rent, whatever that might be, and it falls within our purview, then we do our best to try to help you. We try fulfill your request 100%. We can't always. We do have a limit on what we can give just because our resources are limited. We have had people who have, quite frankly, much larger issues than they're behind a month or two on this or that. And we are not a social service. And we have to often remind ourselves that. And we have to be really clear and stay in our lane.
An important question I asked is how GMAF vets the requesters.
People are in dire straits. I mean, there are people who need serious support. We try to help where we can. We're very conscious of people's stories. We don't want to tell the person's story, which, because we could be spot on or we could be way, way off base. So we do like to have a relationship with the requester and try to understand a little bit more about their situation. That gives us more information when we decide to support. And honestly, there are not many people that we've turned down for getting support from us. The only real requirement is that you have to live in Germantown. You have to live in 19144 ZIP or the Germantown parts of 19138. So we have had to tell people that we can't help them because they don't live in our boundaries. But even those folks, we do give them our resource list and we say, we can't help you, but check out this place or check out that place. They might be able to, you know, give you what you need. The kinds of things that we take into consideration would be like if you have children under 18 that you're supporting, if you're also supporting, you know, elderly parents, if you're a single parent. So we have sort of a little bit of a criteria to kind of say, like, how much of an emergency is it? And we ask people to self-identify. Is this a crisis? Like, are you 1 through 5? Like, and people, I think, are really pretty honest. Like, we have people who are like, this is a 3. Like, I really need the help, but I can wait another month, you know, or this is a 5. I'm about to get booted kind of thing. So we do have sort of like a loose criteria, but the only people that we have turned away have been if you don't live in the zip code or if you are not able or willing to provide us with the documentation that we need. So I hate to say this, but we have, you know, you try to do something good and people are going to try to take advantage. And we really haven't had too much of that, but we have had one or two people who, whatever their story is, it was just a little questionable. And, you know, they want money sent here and to not there, and they can't provide the right documentation. And we have to be like, we're sorry, we really just can't help you at this time. But really, I think that's happened twice. You know, it really hasn't, you know, people are grateful that we're there for them. They have, people have expressed a lot of gratitude towards us. We've made connections with people, which has been terrific. I like to think and I hope that we've made a difference for people, no matter how small it is.
As always, I asked Jill what kind of impact she wants to have on the community around her with her work.
I just do what needs to get done. I want to participate. And I do think that every little act of kindness builds on itself. So I do very small things, like I pick up trash on my street and on Germantown Avenue in front near where I live. And I notice, like, every so often somebody will come and say, hey, do you want a hand? Do you want some company? And they'll pick up trash with me. I would like to think that they saw me and they said, hey, I can do that too. Through the Mutual Aid Fund, I am happy that we were able to show kindness and let people know that without knowing who you are, not caring about your financial situation, race, religion, that if you needed support, that we were a place that you could come and ask for it. And while we can't solve all your problems, we could give you like a little breathing room.
Just to put the next part in context, Jill asked me if I was Jewish and recognized the word tzedakah.
Tzedakah is roughly translated as charity, but it's really not charity, right? It's justice. And that the idea behind tzedakah is that you can't solve all the problems, but you're commanded to pick it up in some place, move the ball forward, and then hand it off to someone else to continue the work. So you're commanded to do the work. You're not commanded to finish the work. And so that I've shared that and talked a lot about that with our group, because there have been times when we felt like this is just a drop in the bucket. It's not making a difference. You know, this person needs this much and we can only give them this much. Maybe we shouldn't give them anything at all because it's not going to make any difference. And we have to remind each other that it all makes a difference.
Before we concluded, Jill made a point to thank the other women on the GMAF committee with her.
Some of us knew each other. We didn't all know each other. And during the pandemic, we were really just communicating over the computer, over Zoom. And I have come to feel like I have like a little sisterhood there. These women are just amazing. And we come from different walks of life. We have different jobs, but we're all in Germantown and we're all in the community. So I just wanted to give a shout out to them. And that would be Marie Monique, Lindsay Stolke, Kathy Brown, Brenda Littlejohn, Barbara Dowdell, Tiffany Dominique. I just wanted to say that those women are pretty amazing.
Finally, if you're interested in receiving funds from Germantown Mutual Aid Fund, or if you're interested in supporting the Germantown Mutual Aid Fund, please listen to the following options.
For both of those questions, you can go to greatgtown.org to either make a contribution or to ask for support. And both of those links are on there. And it'll also give you a little bit more about GMAF and also about GREAT in itself. And the only requirement is you have to live in Germantown.
I'd like to thank the Germantown Mutual Aid Fund, GREAT, and Jill Saul for speaking to me.
Thanks for joining us. My name is Gladys Nobrega, and I'm part of the Scrap Radio Project. Indie Radio Garden is a Prometheus Radio Project production.